Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are here today, October 12th, for six cases. We've got five oral arguments, and this will be our second argument on the calendar. The case is Alexander James Ray, petitioner appellant versus State of Minnesota respondent, case A220584. And Council, just a few words before you begin your arguments this morning. You are free to stand at whichever lectern is most comfortable for you. You have options. The one in the center, though, will have the timer on it and the lights. And so if you're interested in seeing that, that might be the one that you choose. We're making an audio recording of the argument this morning. I apologize in advance. We've had some technical difficulties. I think that we've taken care of them, but I apologize if anything should arise. We had some speaker noise during the last argument. I just ask that in ensuring that our audio recording is good and that we know what case we're on, that you please identify yourself and the name of the party you're representing before you begin your arguments. Appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And then please let us know if you have any preference as to how we address you or your client. And with those remarks, I think we're ready to go. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Adam Johnson. I represent the appellant, Alexander Ray, in this appeal from the district court's denial without a hearing of his petition for post-conviction relief in the Hennepin County District Court. Mr. Ray assigns several errors to the district court's order. He has brought some, but not all, of his claims that he made in his petition. Specifically, he brings claims related to biased jurors that served on his jury and his appellate counsel's failure to raise claims related to those biases in his direct appeal. The reason that those claims were not raised isn't because they were reviewed for their merit and discarded as a strategy or because of appellate counsel's decision that they did not have merit, but rather because the voir dire transcript from appellant's trial was never ordered in the direct appeal. It's appellant's position that had those transcripts been ordered, the issues related to the biases expressed by jurors 6, 13, 14, and 19 would have been discovered, would have been raised, and would have resulted in a structural error reversal in appellant's direct appeal. I want to talk first about juror 14. That claim is distinct because with respect to juror 14, a four-cause challenge was made by appellant's trial counsel and was denied on the record during the trial proceedings. Juror 14, among others, filled out a juror questionnaire and raised concerns in that questionnaire as to her partiality in the trial and whether she could be an impartial juror. She requested to speak privately with the court and the attorneys. She indicated that she had been sexually assaulted at age 14 at a friend's house, that she was unsure whether she could be impartial, that she was not believed with respect to the incident that occurred against her. Under questioning by the district court, she indicated that, quote, "We all like to think that we can be impartial, but we come with stuff that's happened." She made repeated statements as to her uncertainty as to whether she could sit as a fair and impartial juror in the case. When the district court asked if it was possible for the juror to not see herself in this situation, that is, not see herself as the complaining witness in appellant's case, the juror answered, "It would be my hope." And specifically, and I think of particular importance here, the district court asked, "You're aware of your own biases," to which the juror responded, "Yes."
Now, The state's arguing that the juror's comments didn't rise to the level of actual bias, and the district court's comments in addressing the motion to remove the juror for cause suggest that the district court didn't think so either. My recollection, and I guess I have it right here, is that the district court said, she didn't say one way or another that she could be impartial or, you know, that she had biases. Do you agree with the state's interpretation of those remarks as a finding that there was not actual bias?
I agree that they are findings, of course. I don't agree with the state's interpretation of those findings. And I know the portion of the district court's comments that Your Honor is referring to. To quote the district court, it stated, she didn't flat out say, I can be impartial. She didn't flat out say, she couldn't be impartial. She's just super aware of her inherent biases. But I don't think there's enough for cause at this point, but I'll keep an eye out for her as she answers other questions. And I think that's the portion that you're referring to.
It is.
Within that, those findings are a finding that the juror was biased. The juror may have been aware of that bias.
And are you referring to the comment of inherent biases?
Correct.
And you think that's a finding of an actual bias?
I do think it's a finding of bias. I think there's inconsistency with respect to the district court's findings because, of course, if the district court consciously is finding a juror to have a bias that makes them unsuitable to serve on the jury, the consequence of that is to grant the for-cause challenge, which didn't occur. And so there may be some conflict with respect or some inconsistency with the way that the district court expressed its findings. I think ultimately the district court did not believe there was enough for a for-cause challenge grant with respect to juror 14, but did find that the juror was biased, and I believe that that finding of bias does constitute actual bias under the case law.
Now, the district court said, I'll keep an eye out for any responses that juror number 14 makes that may elevate this to a for-cause situation, and I didn't see that there was any motion made down the line to remove juror 14 for cause. Was there anything on the part of the attorney to renew the motion or any comments made on the part of juror 14 suggesting that, you know, there should have been a reason to renew the motion?
There was not further questioning by appellant's trial counsel of juror 14. And that sort of bleeds into the claim that appellant's making here respecting his client's effectiveness or his attorney's effectiveness at trial.
Why would this be an effective assistance?
His trial attorney waived voir dire in its entirety in a criminal sexual conduct first degree case and in total asked three questions of the entire panel during the entirety of voir dire. Two of those questions were asked of juror 14 in making its way towards his for-cause challenge to that juror. But
couldn't that be a trial strategy?
On the record here, I don't believe it is trial strategy. I think that it's negligence. And I think that if subjectively the attorney comes to a conclusion that a juror is unsuitable to serve because they've expressed a bias strong enough to bring a for-cause challenge, does not question that juror further when the opportunity arises to try and establish further grounds for a challenge for cause, but also does not even exercise a peremptory strike, having the knowledge that the attorney has that the juror is not suitable.
I tried a lot of jury trials of criminal cases, and I had situations where there was some issue similar to this, and where the attorneys didn't pursue cause dramatically and didn't strike them preemptively. And when I later talked to the attorney about why were you doing that, because there's a good quality attorney, his response to me was, I like honest jurors, and I like people that can look at their biases and say they're going to deal with it, because I've been over backwards for myself. Why wouldn't that be a good strategy?
It very well could be in certain circumstances. I don't think there was any strategy here at all. One of the portions...
But she was on the case, he was.
That's true. I believe that if there had been an evidentiary hearing granted, the facts would reveal that he got the case file from appellant's counsel of record the night before the Monday trial started and went with it.
Are you arguing that the district court erred in denying an evidentiary hearing?
I am.
Okay. And is that raised in your brief?
The request for the reversal, I think, has an inherent challenge to the failure of granting an evidentiary hearing.
But that's not a standalone argument that you're making in your brief.
Correct.
Okay.
The main argument is for a reversal, and I think the strongest argument, candidly, is the challenge that was made and denied to Juror 14 and Juror 14 service on the jury. The corollary, if you will, argument with respect to the remaining jurors has an additional step of establishing the ineffective assistance of trial counsel, which is not present with respect to the claim related to Juror 14.
So with regard to Juror 14, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, Gelino or Gelino decision, which involves a similar claim of ineffective assistance of counsel based on decisions made during jury selection. There, the court said it's really, given the amount of strategy involved in picking a jury, it's only going to be a rare case where, a reviewing court says this was an effective assistance of counsel. And you addressed that case in your brief and noted that this was such a rare case because defense counsel asked just three questions during voir dire. I would note that the district court was quite active during the voir dire process as well, asked a lot of questions. Do you have any argument other than the fact that defense counsel didn't get rid of 14 and asked three questions that would convince us that this is the rare case mentioned or referenced in the Gelino decision?
And Your Honor, I don't know if it's Gelino or Gelino, but counsel and I had a handshake agreement prior to coming in that we would say Gelino.
Okay, all right. I'm with you then. I'll call it Gelino as well.
The record as a whole, I certainly agree that the district court was active and appellant's counsel would have the benefit of the questions and answers from the district court. As further evidence of counsel's deficiency, I would point to several jurors, namely 6, 13, and 19, who made at a minimum equivocal statement suggesting their inability to be impartial or bias, if you will, to which no follow-up questions were asked at all to even explore topics relevant to later peremptory strikes, not necessarily going after each one for cause, because it's not required, and I'm not arguing that would be required, but even the exploration of certain topics with respect to jurors who I think from the record made concerning statements, at least in the context of this kind of case, past instances that either they themselves or a family member had suffered, it would be typical or usual to see at least some questions asked to confirm that the juror does have the ability to set aside any preconceived notions that they've evidenced during the district court's questioning to sit fairly in the case. One thing discussed in the briefing that I would like to just reference or discuss briefly are the district court's findings. I do think that the decisions in Bergendahl and Danbury, while non-precedential and not binding on the court, are very persuasive. They both involved first-degree criminal sexual conduct prosecutions with single biased jurors that sat in judgment of the defendants. Appellant is not relying upon those decisions for a rule of law, for example. They are useful for their analyses. I would argue they're very closely analogous to the facts and circumstances of the instant case, especially Danbury. I do think there's even a stronger case in appellant's case for a reversal. In Danbury and Bergendahl, the challenged jurors both had family members who had been subject to either abuse or a criminal sexual conduct assault. Here, Juror 14 was herself the victim of a sexual offense and stated in her question and answer with the district court that it was amazing how many, after all of these years, it still impacted her.
But in Danbury, the comments were, in response to the questions about whether the juror could be fair, I honestly don't know. I can't promise. I'm uncertain. Beyond the comment that you just referenced, where the juror sort of trailed off, were there any comments that this juror made, juror 14, that were that unequivocal about her ability to be fair?
Again, there was a question by the district court as to whether the juror was aware of her own biases, to which the juror responded in the affirmative. And so there's some mitigation, I think, built into that because we think, oh, you're aware of your own bias, therefore you're unlikely to be biased. But the case law compels that the two-pronged test be followed. If there's bias, there then needs to be rehabilitation. And so the affirmation of bias by the juror, appellant argues, is an expression of actual bias. So prong one is met. The court then moves on to prong two, rehabilitation, which requires there to be an unequivocal statement by the juror that they can set aside any preconceived notions and follow the district court's instructions and fairly judge the case. I would argue that that's not present here and would be grounds for reversal in a direct appeal, and that opportunity was missed. I see that my time is almost up, so I'd be happy to answer any further questions now or later.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm the district court's order because the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying appellant's petition for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. At the root of the issues appellant has raised, he has failed to show that juror 14 expressed actual bias. And that is to say that juror 14 did not exhibit such strong and deep impressions that would prevent her from being able to decide the case on the evidence. Relatedly, his appellant has failed to show that his trial attorney's performance in voir dire was objectively unreasonable, and this is an area that is entirely within the province of trial strategy. Because there's no valid claim of a biased juror or ineffective assistance of counsel, appellant's claim that his attorney on direct appeal was ineffective also fails.
Counsel, though, the problem I think in this case is highlighted by the end of appellant's argument, where you pointed to the fact that the judge never asked that magical question, considering your experience. Are you satisfied that you can set that aside and decide this case fully on the facts and the evidence that are presented? Isn't that what we
I think that the state asked questions along those lines. It probably wasn't worded exactly like what we might like to see here, but in terms of the follow-up questions after, I think that was after the denial for cause, that the state raised those kinds of follow-up questions. Certainly any record we look at could have more questions. You know, we could have maybe clearer questions that ask exactly what we'd like to see when we're on appeal. But I think here the fact is that when you look at the statements juror 14 made, in my view, there's no statement you can point to say that is where juror 14 is exhibiting strong and deep impressions that prevent her from hearing this case on the evidence.
In the Danbury case, which appellant is relying on here, the non-precedential decision, the panel found that the district court had implicitly made a finding of actual bias. Did the district court here implicitly, although not directly, make such a finding?
That's right. That is where I see the biggest distinction with Danbury, which obviously is only persuasive, not binding on this court. I would say that these types of cases are highly fact-specific. And here, you know, not having obviously viewed the trial record in Danbury, but that is the finding that the panel made, was that implicitly the district court was finding actual bias. And here I think the reverse is true. My interpretation of the district court's remarks are that there's no finding of actual bias made. I know near the end of opposing counsel's argument, he brought up the question that the district court said to juror number 14, something along the lines of, so you're aware of your own biases, you know, that kind of question. And to me, I think that overstates that kind of question to say that the fact that the district court used the word bias in the question to the juror, that means that she's talking about a legal definition of actual bias versus just the thoughts we all have when we enter the courtroom. So in the state's view, looking at the comments the district court made when the challenge for cause was made, also in conjunction with the post-conviction order, I think there's no finding of actual bias.
Did either the prosecutor or the court at any time just ask the point blank question, despite your prior experiences with this type of case, are you satisfied that you can set those experiences aside and decide this case on the facts of the law? Is that ever?
I will look right now at the transcript. I think that the state asks something along the lines of setting aside your bias and making an objective decision, but it doesn't look like the question was framed that way, which might have been more helpful.
So is hope enough to show a lack of actual bias? Because that's what we've got here. She says, I hope so. And this deeply impacted me.
Right.
But I hope I can set it aside.
So I have two answers to that. I think the first is that we start with, is there an expression of this strong and deep, you know, point of view that you cannot look at this objectively? So you have to exhibit the actual bias before we look at, oh, have we rehabilitated the juror? And I think that the I hope so goes more towards the rehabilitation. At no point has she said, I feel so strongly about these cases that I can't look at this in that way. So that's the first part of my answer. The second part of my answer, I think, really gets to sort of the standard of review and the level of deference in these cases. So I think that that State versus Munt has this really powerful language when it talks about the level of deference when looking at the determination of a biased juror as being sort of at its pinnacle of deference. And it talks about sort of the review of a cold transcript. And I think that we can all sort of picture why it is so difficult to review these kinds of statements. Because when a juror says something like, I think so, I mean, what goes into that includes facial expression, tone of voice, body language, demeanor. So someone could say those words and be shrinking back in their seat. They could be looking around nervously. Their voice could be quavering. They could look very uncomfortable when they say, I think so. Or someone could say, I think so. And they could say it powerfully and confidently and look relaxed and you know, like they don't have an issue with the case at hand. And so I think that that's why we really defer to district courts in these sort of settings, because there is a lot that's not on paper when it comes to I think so, I hope so, in terms of what that person is communicating to the people in the room. And so I think that's the challenge, and that's why there's so much deference from this court looking at the district court. And then sort of as a corollary, that's why it's such a matter of trial strategy, because the people in the room are going to be developing rapport with those jurors. They're going to have sort of their own subjective instincts about it, their own experience as trial attorneys. So it's really a strategic decision about who they keep, who they challenge, who they question more. And so I think that all kind of wraps into that.
Counsel, if you agree that there was, or I guess if we conclude that there was sufficient actual bias here to sort of trigger that requirement for rehabilitation, do you agree that the rehabilitation that occurred was insufficient?
I mean, I think that that definitely makes this case more challenging. Obviously, the state's position is that actual bias has not been established, but I think that if you're looking at rehabilitation, you know, it's obviously a much closer call given the language in Fraga. And so although we need to give deference to the district court who was there, I think that that makes it a much closer call. If there are no further questions at this time from the panel,
I do have one more question. I'm not going to let you go yet.
Oh, that's fine.
I want to talk a little bit about the failure to order the transcripts of voir dire. Is that a per se ineffective action? And I'll certainly question appellant's counsel about that. I just want to hear the state's thoughts about the failure to order the transcripts to even discover that these potential issues existed.
Sure. I think the state would caution against a rule that would be per se ineffective. I think that, like any case, an appellate attorney, it's going to be a case-by-case decision, and I assume that the appellate public defender's office needs to make those decisions about what transcripts they're going to pay for. Obviously, there's a cost involved. There's time in terms of it'll take longer to get transcripts, and you know, I could see how that an appellate attorney might not decide to order those in every single case. I assume that it would be, you know, based in part on speaking to perhaps the trial attorney, if they're able to get, you know, any feedback from them, from talking to the client about what their concerns were. Here are the concerns that the client raised on direct appeal based on the exhibits that were submitted to the with the post-conviction filings. The client's concern at that juncture was about ineffective assistance of counsel in that there was sort of a last-minute attorney who stepped in. So that was the concerns raised. And I think that had his own client had, you know, concerns, not that they would know in a legal sense, but concerns about how jury selection, you know, arose, then I assume the appellate attorney would probably order those transcripts to see if there was an issue. So, you know, to me, I think that an appellate attorney is going to be making those strategic decisions about how to handle a case, and it seems that that I would caution against sort of a per se rule that they have to order those transcripts. I assume that it would be sort of a case-by-case decision. And if there's no further questions, I would rest on my brief, and I would respectfully request this court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just wanted to briefly touch upon a question that was asked by Judge Kirk respecting whether there was an unequivocal statement by a juror, the second prong of the juror bias analysis. And I think what counsel may have been referring to is on page 61 of the first day of jury selection transcript, where counsel for the state at trial asked the juror, "And I think what you're telling us, you're saying you hope you can set aside, you can set any sort of bias aside. So then are you saying that you will do your best to set any sort of bias that you recognize aside and make an objective decision?" To which the juror answered yes. And within that question are do your best, as well as hope that you can do something. Both statements that previous cases, and I wish I had the citations to them now, ruled were not unequivocal statements by jurors that would satisfy prong two of the analysis. And so I just wanted to mention that for sake of the record and your convenience.
In a sense, though, aren't we asking a lot of jurors when we expect them to be able to tell us at that point how they may react to something that they haven't seen yet, which is a presentation of the case?
We may be, although I know of no alternative than to ask a lot of jurors, and I know that a lot is already asked of them, but nobody can predict how they're going to react subjectively to graphic images on a display in a trial that they weren't anticipating, but they're not imperfect tribunals, but we do our best, and I think that asking jurors to make that type of unequivocal statement that they can set aside any partiality and judge the case fairly is appropriate and borne out in the case law. Did Your Honor want to discuss the ordering of the transcripts issue?
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to me that it wouldn't matter, right, unless you prevailed on the ineffective assistance of trial counsel issue, but I'm just interested to hear your thoughts about, you know, whether there should be a per se rule, whether it's case specific, whether ordering the transcript is all going to depend on what surfaces when a post-conviction attorney, you know, orders those transcripts. If you could speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
Just as an attorney, you know, making an observation, I would be reluctant to advocate for a per se rule of that nature. I know there are certain misdemeanor cases where the attorneys decide to not even record jury selection. But here we have a first-degree criminal sexual conduct case where these types of issues are highly likely, and I would suggest more likely to occur than in other cases where people have been impacted in their personal lives and are now jurors having to decide something that may be affected by their personal life. And here, I agree, the appellant does not prevail with respect to the Strickland analysis if the juror bias issue is not persuasive. But in this case, counsel on appeal should have and attempted to obtain the transcripts from jury selection. There was a letter that had gone out from the appellate public defender's office to attorney John Price, who was the counsel of record for the appellant at trial, asking, was there anything that happened during jury selection that would necessitate the ordering of the transcripts? So the appellate public defender's office was mindful of the potential need for those transcripts. Unfortunately, and it's unknown from the existing record, there was no reply to that letter and the transcripts were never ordered. But again, I'm not suggesting that there need be, from this court, a per se rule fashioned that says in every single criminal case it's per se ineffective assistance of counsel to not order transcripts from jury selection. Unless there are any other questions, I would yield.
All right, thank you. Thank you both very much. The case was very well briefed and argued. It is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.